Hello, you discerning, incomparable network listener, you. I'm Erica Ensign, and for this 10th anniversary of The Incomparable, Lisa Schmeiser and I bring you, and The Incomparable Network, a new podcast, Saga of Rereading Epics. Because it's not only the 10th anniversary of our network's flagship show, it's also exactly 90 years from when Group Green steps through the time portal at Madame Guderian's Auberge and emerges in Earth's Pleistocene Epoch, August 25th, 2110. Meanwhile, here in 2020, this is also the time of year when we tell you about how you can support this new podcast, and many others, by becoming a member of The Incomparable. It's super easy to sign up for a monthly or annual pledge and support this spiffy new podcast directly. Here's what to do. Go to theincomparable.com/members and sign up. It'll ask you to pick the shows on the network you want to support, check the little box for Saga of Rereading Epics, and your contribution will come to us after a few very reasonable fees are taken out. If you listen to other podcasts on the Incomparable Network, and you should, you can also check their boxes, and your contribution will be shared equally by all shows you want to support. As a thank you for supporting us, members receive lots of extras. There's a really nice members-only Slack community with a whole channel devoted to talking about books. It's pretty great. There are exclusive bonus podcast feeds, including the Bootleg Podcast, where you can hear unedited episodes of many shows, including this one, right after they're recorded. There are also bonus episodes posted into a special feed, which you'll be seeing a lot this month, but there's new stuff in there throughout the year. For example, this podcast will drop monthly. We figured one book per month for a read-along podcast seems like a very doable pace. But if you're a voracious reader like we are, you can become a member to get fully edited episodes of Saga of Rereading Epics on a weekly basis until we catch up to where we are in our recording schedule. As of right now, we are through episode 7, so that's almost 2 months' worth of early access goodness in The Incomparable's first-class feed. There are contribution levels at $5, $10, and $20 per month, and annual equivalents are available as well. We even take Apple Pay. Fancy schmancy. And if you're already a member, it's really easy to increase your pledge to a higher level and get some special goodies in return. So if you'd like to support us, go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up. Thank you so much for considering it. And now, without further ado, I give you the introductory episode of Saga of Rereading Epics. Enjoy. Welcome to the inaugural episode of Saga of Rereading Epics. I am Erica Ensign.
I'm Lisa Schmeiser.
And in this podcast, we will be rereading, reconsidering, and refeeling each book in Julian May's Saga of Pleistocene Exile and the Galactic Milieu series. And yes, that includes Intervention, which we will split into two books as it was originally published. But before we get too deep into the whys and the hows, let's take a moment to introduce ourselves. Lisa, please tell our discerning and intelligent listeners where they can find you on the internet and how you first discovered this series.
Okay, each and every one of our listeners is a fabulous shining jewel. We cherish you all. Let's just get that out of the way.
You're here.
I think the best way to find me is probably on Twitter at L Schmeiser, L-S-C-H-M-E-I-S-E-R. And I also have a small artisanal newsletter with only the finest curated news and pop culture analysis at tinyletter.com/L-S-C-H-M-E-I-S-E-R. I also pop up pretty frequently on Incomparable Podcasts, which I suspect is how you're sliding into this podcast here. And I actually sort of fell into this series in the middle because our library had picked up Surveillance and Metaconcert, and I read those first. And then I was sufficiently intrigued by the author that I was able to go back and find the Saga of Pleistocene Exile and read my way through that. And it kind of blew my mind at the time. Well, you have to understand, there's a real, and we'll discuss this more in this series, there's a real tonal shift that takes place starting with Intervention and going through. And so to go from these books where there's a lot of big questions on what is the nature of humanity, what is the responsibility that people who have extraordinary talents have to the rest of society, where is there room for self-actualization in that? Is self-actualization something that's actually to the benefit of people or not? Like, all of these questions get batted around in the Surveillance and the Metaconcert. And then you go back to the many colored land and it is savage. Oh my gosh. And the tone shift and the subject shift were so shocking to me as a teenager. I did a reread, I want to say about 10 years ago. And then I came to really appreciate that from a serious perspective and an evolving author perspective, it makes a lot of sense the way she did what she did. Mm-hmm. But the way that Julian May takes 9 books to reconcile questions like what makes a culture and when do cultures deserve to live or die and how do you balance the wants of an individual against the needs of the group and when is it necessary to assert the rights of the individual over the needs of a group and what is life's purpose and what is life's meaning. Like the way she moves through all of that over the course of the 9 books is really remarkable, and it has one of the best endings I've ever seen in an epic. So I've never been able to get the books off my mind for that reason. And in many ways, I feel like a lot of the things that embroider this series, from the space travel to the intrigues between different races, to the time travel, to the revival of courtly traditions, to psychic war, like all of those are basically just tiny tools in service of her giving out a series of big messages. And it's really well done. And to be honest, I'm always a little gobsmacked that more people don't love the sweep and scope and skill that went into this whole series. Like, it amazes me that this series is not talked about the same way that we talk about George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire, or the Tolkien epics or things like that, just because it's so good on so many levels.
Hear, hear. Okay, so follow up, introduce myself. You can find me primarily on Twitter. I am at Holly Go Darkly. That's Holly with 2 L's and Go Darkly with, you know, the way you spell those 2 words.
I always loved your name.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I am also on a boatload of podcasts here on the Incomparable Network, including Beginner's Puck talking about hockey and Erp Chirp talking about Winona Earp. So I get around and I talk about a lot of stuff. I think I'm primarily known for Verity. It's a Doctor Who podcast, but I also do Lazy Doctor Who on the Incomparable Network. And I play Dungeons and Dragons on Total Party Kill. There's a lot of me on the internet. And if you Google, you will find it. So that's that. I first came across these books. My mom is a huge nerd and was reading science fiction books just like for my entire life. And this was a series that that she suggested. She said she really, really liked them and I should try reading them. And it actually took me 2 times to get into mm-hmm. it. I found the beginning of The Many-Colored Land a little slow and put it down and did other stuff and didn't come back to it again until later. And then somehow managed, I don't know if I think I still found the beginning a little slow, but I got past that chunk of it and then just fell headlong into these books. And mm-hmm. yeah, I experienced them from first publication to final publication. So I am like slightly mind boggled at the idea of going, yeah, from sort of the middly bit back to the beginning, because it was also like pretty mind blowing to go from the beginning and then mm-hmm. reach the middle. Because it is it like no matter which way you approach it, it's a tonal shift, and it is it's just fantastic. So without getting too spoilery, and I'll say right now, if you want to have absolutely zero spoilers, you should probably just go and read the books right now. But overall, the Saga of Pliocene Exile is the first bit that she wrote. It's a story of a group of people from the 22nd century who don't really feel like they fit into their modern society. So they travel through a one-way time gate back to Earth's Pliocene Exile, hoping to live simply and quietly in sort of a more primitive society. But what they find when they get there is very, very different from that. In fact, this part of the Pliocene epoch is ruled by aliens, and humans are largely treated as slaves or serfs. So that's what you got going on in those books. And then the Galactic Milieu series, which was written later, largely follows one family, actually from a time like shortly after World War II. And in this version of Earth, people have started to develop metapsychic powers. So Intervention tells the story of how Earth becomes a larger or a part of a larger galactic community. And then the following 3 books after that is sort of a more focused story about it kind of follows several members of that family that are exceedingly talented in the use of their metapsychic power. So that's like
a giant family argument. It is literally 3 books of a family argument over how to use your psychic powers.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And it's glorious. Oh, it's so good.
so let's dig into our thoughts and feels about all of these books. Lisa, you covered some of this a little bit, but like in broad general strokes, why do you love these two series? And then why do you think a new reader now might get some value out of reading these books?
I'll start with the second part first. Mm-hmm. And I think the value to audiences that haven't read these books before, one, they're finished. Like you don't have to.
No, you're right. That's so good. Continue.
No, and I say this as somebody who like went to the Harry Potter release parties, and I say this as somebody who's actually, eagerly awaited follow-ups and to planned trilogies and things like that. There's something to be said for there being a set of works that you just haven't tackled yet that are done, where everything has been said and the author is not on Twitter going, oh, and by the way, this character is also a practicing Reiki therapist or whatever. Like none of that. It's just this whole perfect work. And what you can do is you can dive in and read all 9 books and then just kind of sit there with it and like let the universe that she's created slosh around gently. And why? And so aside from that reading experience, the second reason you want to dive in is, again, I may have made the book sound like they're all high flown and these are characters who are busy, screaming, no, life is nasty, brutal and short. No, it's not. It's not like that. There are capers. These books have, some capers. There's buddy comedy thrown into there. There's some high fantasy romance. And you want to read them because you want to see what an author can do with all of those tropes and how she weaves them together into an overarching story where, you start off with one thing and one status quo. And at the end of the book, everything has changed. It makes sense why everything has changed. And it advances a big story where over the, say, the saga, the Pleistocene Exile, it starts off with a bunch of 22nd century folks basically want to go live in yurts. And by the end, and then discover they're actually just pawns in a nasty alien battle. And by the end of the fourth book, it's everyone has learned how to get along. And it's fun getting from point A to point B. And then with intervention, it's the same thing, which is the question of what does a human society do when there's the potential for enormous technological and social disruption? And you can't stamp out that disruption is going to happen. The question is, how is it going to happen? And you read those because, again, there's kind of a real cloak and dagger quality to it and almost a spy novel aspect with things being very carefully put into place. And there's a femme fatale and like ridiculous rich people. It's delightful. And then again, in the last 3 books, which are about, again, one spectacularly talented family having a very long argument over the best way to be psychics in the galaxy. You go to these bonkers planets where, there's diamonds just laying on the ground, or they're like very fiercely ethno-nationalist. And then that's the question of how do these planets all get along and how do they handle integrating into a galaxy where there's several other sentient species? And the argument that people have just kind of sprawls over 3 books. But at the same time, again, it's really funny and it's fun. And May does a really good job of making sure all the way through all 9 books that if somebody takes themselves too seriously, like the reader knows what's going to happen. There's plenty of comic relief. No one in the book is an unfeeling automaton. It's just big and it gives you a lot of room to swim around in and find what you like and be delighted by her world building, which is really careful and really well considered, to be delighted by her wordplay. Like she's not, I think what I really admire about May as a prose stylist too, is she's vivid and descriptive. She does a great job of writing from multiple points of view, but she's not inaccessible. It's mm-hmm. just, it's work that's so good you don't realize how good it is until you try and do something like that yourself. And then you're like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just a tremendous economy of, like, she's not showy. She's just really good. And to be good at world building, to be good at thinking your way through hard questions, to be good at plotting, to be good at pacing, to be good at characterization, and to do it all while also writing well, it's just a really nice package. And it's not frustrating. Like there's not any parts of the book that have ever been frustrating me. There have been parts that have been emotionally upsetting for one reason or another. Mm. But you think about that, that's actually a good thing because it means you're so engaged in the experience.
Yeah. I think for me, it was always, it was the characters that just absolutely drew me in. I felt like, you know, there are a lot of main characters. I wouldn't say it's quite like ensemble drama, like, you know, a television show with 24 main characters. But throughout, you get a number of characters that all have very important parts to play in these stories. And each one of them feels like a fully realized person. They want to do the things that they want to do, or they have the fears of the things that the other people are wanting to do. And it makes perfect sense. When you're reading a section with character A, you know where they're coming from and why they want to do what they want to do. And then you go to character B, and maybe, you know, I as a reader don't agree with what character B wants to do. You know, like, I'm on character A's side all the time, but I completely understand why character B is feeling the way that they are feeling. They have a perfectly cromulent argument for the thing that they want to do. And I just, like, I think the best books are the kind that make me feel like it's a realistic argument. You talk about the long-term family argument about how to be a psychic in the universe. And yeah, I never feel like there are like clear-cut good guys and bad guys. We don't.
No
have
one
the...
is ever wrong. Yes, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know,
It's not white hats versus black hats. Yeah, you know.
And one of the things that I found interesting is the first time I read these books, there were a couple characters that really put me off on first read. Mm-hmm. Just I couldn't understand why on earth these drips were in the book. Like, why are we spending so much time when this other person is clearly so much more interesting? And on the last reread that I did, I was like, oh, now I get this person. Now I get why they're there. Mm-hmm. And I get, like you said, the role that they play in the story. And that made me appreciate them more, even if my initial reaction, like, there is a main character who, and this is no spoiler, there's a main, she kills off people all the way through the books. Like, you know, you're not going to have like this. There's that famous photo where somebody took a picture of a George R. R. Martin book and put a post-it on every page where someone died, and the book is basically just a stack of post-its. Like, it's not like that, but she's not afraid to kill off characters when their death will serve a purpose and advance the story. And this particular character's story is done. And when I encountered that as a teen, it was actually like every time there was a death, it was like it was legitimately shocking, where you're like, oh my god, oh. And then the second time I went back and read, I was like, oh, this makes sense. Oh yeah.
Yeah, I feel like that's another good argument for why somebody either might want to come to these new, or if you've read these books and it was a long time ago, it's absolutely worth a reread, because, you know, as you change as a person over the years, the way that you read and the characters that you empathize with definitely changes. And I have read through these a couple of times, and yeah, I've enjoyed it both times, but got a very different experience out of it. So, I hope that this has convinced some people to go and seek out these amazing books. I know they can be a little bit hard to get. I think they're mostly out of print, so you might need to visit some used bookstores, check out some resellers on Amazon. If you live in Canada, I'm afraid there is no Kindle available, a Kindle version available on Amazon.ca, but I believe there's one in the US. Lisa, am I correct there?
Yes. And I was going to say, if you do go through resellers on Amazon, I've found that if you're willing to take time and scroll through the options, sometimes you'll find that one reseller will have two or three of the books as a whole. And it doesn't ever hurt to just reach out an email and ask, hey, would you mind, you know, bundling these together and just doing shipping for one, as opposed to me having to pay, you know, $5.95 in shipping for all of them. A lot of times people will work with you, which
That's
is
awesome.
Especially if shipping is a concern. But yeah, also check your library. Some of them may still have the back five in circulation. It's harder to find the first four in libraries, especially since a lot of libraries are very aggressive about pulling books if they haven't been checked out for a while. It is still worth, if you're in, say, Los Angeles County. The Los Angeles County libraries are amazing. For anybody who doesn't know, if you are anywhere in Los Angeles County, you can put a hold on a book and ask for it to be delivered to your nearest branch, and you have all of the resources of all of Los Angeles County at your disposal. They are one of the best stocked library systems in America, and they are also really good at making sure books get into people's hands. I used to use them all the time when I lived in Los Angeles, and I read just an amazing variety of out-of-print books. So if you're in Los Angeles, please consider that.
Cool. Yes. So we beseech you, find these books if you if you can. So if you are off to find these books and read them for the first time and you want no spoilers, then I encourage you to pause the podcast right now. We will still be here waiting for you, I promise. But right now, Lisa and I are about to dive headlong into spoiler territory and talk about some more sort of specific memories. So, Lisa, now, without editing yourself, what are some of your really standout memories of these books? Why have they held such a special place in your heart for so long? Give me some dirt.
Oh, my gosh. The the group of psychic exiles who, you know, lose their galactic war, you know, Mark Remillard and his crew. It was interesting watching that group and watching the kids rebel against them. But when Mark lays down the punishment on his best friend Alex, and Alex goes walking across the deck and his feet are bleeding, and it's just something Mark was able to do with the power of his mind. Like, that imagery has never left. So it's just the idea of so all the scenes between Mark and Alex were very powerful. Brian Grenfell's whole doomed romance, largely one-sided romance, with Mercy Lamal.
Yes.
You know, the first time I read Mercedes Limbaugh, the first time I read that, I was like, Brian, you're an idiot. Like, again, as a teenager, I'm like, Brian, you're an idiot. You're an idiot. Look, and it's terrible. And then the second time I read it through, I had more sympathy both for him and for her. Cause, you know, like, she never asked for his attention or his affection. She had no obligation to return it. And it's such a nice, gutting of the romantic myth, or even the rom-com trope, that if a really nice guy really loves you enough, shouldn't you open your heart and let him in? And I like that the answer is no, I appreciate that a lot more now. And her whole arc is just so, what I love about it is how every step of the way it confounds, like, the high romance fantasy where it's this lady that people fight over and they've got this great courtly love and so on and so forth. And you basically realize she's as shrewd an operator as everybody else is. And she may love her high Tanu lord, but she has no problem using and abusing Aiken Drum. She has no problem with, you know, using Brian to further her ends. And watching her wield power and then fall victim to it, I think was like the first time when I read it through, I'm like, no, Mercedes is kind of terrible anyway. And the second time I read it through, I'm like, she's one of the best anti-heroes that I've seen in fiction.
Yep.
Like, just amazing. And so I love that. I've always loved, Anna Maria Recaro, the nun.
Yeah,
and especially her attempted relationship with Felice, and I also again think Felice Landry is up there in the ranks of like great psychopaths, along with any one of the little princelings from Game of Thrones. And I know I keep harping on Game of Thrones largely because it's ended, but as a viewer, one of the things I found most interesting is you always have these perverted little princelings all over the place, and oh, they're terrible, oh, they let people be eaten by dogs, oh, they choke on pies, and and I, you know, again, Felice can stand up with any of those guys. She's amazing. Like, she's just this really well-written, again, she's written as a legitimate psychopath where her brain is wired the wrong way, and because it's made extremely clear that this is how she's made, she becomes less an object of like terrible fascination and more like a walking moral quandary. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, should she have been euthanized just by virtue of being born the way she was? Or was there any hope of redemption for her or anything like that? And I also like that Felice keeps popping up, or rather Felice's final form keeps popping up over and over again through the last five books. Like, once I realized what that was, because again, I started in the middle, went back, and then was like, the gem, the family carbuncle. Oh my God. Oh my God. it, you know, and the nice thing about it is you could like drop in on the last three books and have the family carbuncle and not realize it, but it's just this really nice little Easter egg. And, again, what stuck with me the first time I read the books was the sheer scope and scale of the savagery. you know, it's just brutal for the people who go back and are surprised you're now working for, you're now enslaved in a race of aliens, and they love to have jousts and battles, and you're just human props for amusement. And it's horrifying when you read about it, and it's horrifying. And May doesn't spare any, it's not gory, but she doesn't spare you the realities of the descriptions in the world building. And at the same time, you have people who are either thrust into leadership roles or assume them because they genuinely want to change things. And the fact that leadership is never glamorized or made sexy, there are no inevitable heroes. It was really heady stuff for an American teenager, yeah. Especially one where a lot of sci-fi epics or a lot, well, let's start with fantasy epics. A lot of fantasy epics is always the chosen one. Oh, stable boy. You may think you're a stable boy, but your natural talent with a sword shows me you're the chosen one. Or, oh, sweet seamstress, didn't you ever wonder about that diamond necklace your mother hid in the straw? Well, it tells us you're a princess. You get a lot of those types of stories, and this is not like that. Everybody here makes choices, and they're responsible for both the choices and the consequence of their choices. And to be exposed to that idea as a teenager, that a lot of your life is going to revolve around the choices you make and figuring out how to live with those consequences and what those choices and those consequences and your reactions say about you as a person, like, that was a really formative idea.
Yeah.
So that's stuff.
Yeah. I think you touched on something that made it really huge for me. And that was, yes, as a teenager, I had read a lot of fantasy, and it really, much of it was in that same vein of, you know, the plot beats became apparent pretty quickly, and you know, I just knew what to expect. Here's, you know, you get from point A to point B, and then you go to point C, and then you fight a dragon, and then you're the king, the end. This was so not that. So I think the thing that just stuck with me so much about it was the fact that my expectations were subverted over and over again, and then I would just have these moments of, holy crap, like, what the hell? Just you know, even the moment of stepping through the time gate at the beginning, you know, I'm expecting kind of what these characters are expecting, to go back and build some yurts and, you know, start farming and learn how to sail on the you know, ancient oceans, although apparently not the Mediterranean because it doesn't exist yet. And then, you know,
spoiler alert,
so you get the surprise of, oh, there are aliens here. That's mind-blowing. And then, you know, you go through the relationship between the aliens and the humans, and that's mind-blowing. And then, yeah, oh, and by the way, we're just going to create the Mediterranean Ocean by, like, you know, giant psychic powers in order to do what we need to do to save humanity from the awful, awful aliens, which really aren't all that awful because they're just trying to get along, too. So, you know, wonderful, again, wonderful example of different characters and different classes of characters all just fighting for the things that they feel are right. And then, you know, I have to admit, I don't remember the Galactic Milieu series as well because I haven't reread it as many times as I have the first several books. But I do remember really, really loving Intervention and, like, just some of the characters and, you know, Uncle Roji or Rogi. I don't know how you pronounce it out loud.
I think he's pronounced,
yeah,
Rogi.
And just he was just my favorite, and his cat. I was like,
oh, can we talk about him?
Yeah, sure.
Because I think the thing I love about Uncle Rogi is he becomes a primary narrator in the two Intervention books. And then in the Galactic Milieu, he's one of the primary narrators. And what I love is how Julian May makes the choice. He's a really flawed psychic. He's weak.
Not good.
In terms of the rest of, like, the rest of his family are just, like, galaxy class and fantastic, and, like, he can barely stir a teaspoon in his in his coffee cup. But what I love is he's funny and he's flawed and he's irreverent and infinitely loving and compassionate. And she puts him front and center at all of these really important events. And she insists over and over again that you don't have to be remarkable to matter. You don't have to be remarkable to make choices that affect the world. You don't have to be remarkable to be a hero. All you have to do is know why you're doing what you want to do and then do it. And again, you know, you and I have both just talked about this whole fantasy conceit where somebody is discovered to be special. And they're like, oh, I'm special. Off I go. Like, Rogi fights that every step of the way. And I do want to point out that, like, in the last five books, there's the Remillard family are culturally French Canadian and Catholic. And so a lot of Catholic, and one of my favorite characters, Anne, actually becomes a Jesuit priest. And there's a lot of meditation on the role of faith. There's stuff where if you are not a particularly spiritual religious person, like, eh, God bothering, whatever. But what I think is important about Rogi as a character is May is making it's a very biblical argument that May makes with him, through him, I should say, where she's like, look, if you have faith and intention and works, it doesn't matter if you're spectacular. All that matters is that you show up. Mm-hmm. And I'm just really, you don't find a lot of other books that posit that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's why that really sticks with me. I love how she loves her characters.
Mm-hmm. And I think for me, I was more on the sort of like plot side. Like I recognized mm-hmm. all of those things in a way, but I was more sort of mind blown by the fact that, okay, so Uncle Rogi has like the family ghost that just sort of hangs around him yeah. and tells him things mm-hmm. and encourages and discourages and all that stuff. And then when you get far enough along, you realize who that family ghost is. And it's actually
yes,
Mark, who at the end of mm-hmm. the series, like goes back in time and, you know, so he has beaten everybody else to the land of the Tanu, and he's strong enough with his pals to get away from them. So he's just been existing for millions of years and, you know, no longer has his pesky human body. He is just able to be, you know, just a bit of energy with that still has a personality and was formative in actually getting Earth brought into the galactic milieu, and just so many little moments like that connect from the beginning to the end, except that it's because it's timey-wimey, it's from the end to the beginning, and just yeah,
it's like it's one of the few time travel things that actually works
yes.
for me,
because mm-hmm.
time travel as a whole, the problem I have with almost any time travel fiction whatsoever is I find myself plotting off the timeline and ha ha ha, this wouldn't work. Like, this actually works.
Yep. Because it's simple. It's elegant.
It's so good. And what I love about this too is I have a feeling that, and I'm not sure if May did this explicitly or implicitly, and part of the problem is the books were written long enough ago where I don't think there's a body of work where interview-wise yeah. where people ask this question. This seems to me like she read Milton's Paradise Lost, mm-hmm. like paid a lot of attention to the parts with Satan, and then was like, I'm going to write the Satan Redemption because by the end of the very last book, like one of the last lines he says is, you know, au revoir mon oncle. I can't speak French, but basically he says in French, goodbye, my beloved uncle, please pray for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that then, you know, like becomes one with the universe. And for this character who has fought so fiercely to shape worlds and to shape people and to create a metahuman, a race of metahuman psychics and all that, for him to be like, my work here is done. I'm going to gracefully submit to whatever happens next. Boom, off I go. Like, again, I feel like this was May's answer to any one of those great works of literature that's like, nope, Satan's always Satan, never repenting, never seeing the error of his ways. He's just a captivating anti-hero. Like, I feel like this is her extended answer to that. And he's one of my favorite characters.
Yep.
Like, I really enjoy him. I enjoy Rogi. If I had a quibble, it's that I don't think a lot of the female characters have the same depth and richness. Mm-hmm. Like I do have a lot of characters in the series that I really like who are female. Like I love Anne Remillard, the one who eventually becomes the Jesuit. Mm-hmm. And but you know, I think a lot of the times instead, like Shannon, this poor Shannon is just used and abused and discarded at the end of it. It's a tough it's a little tougher to identify with them than with the guys.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this is because May is a product of a very, you know, May has been writing since like the 60s. And so I don't know if this is just a reflection of the convention, the times, what was acceptable for publication. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of fun to think about how the series would play out through the filter of today, especially mm-hmm. you know, especially with authors placing more non-white and gender non-binary characters front and center.
Yeah, like if somebody stumbled upon these and decided that they wanted to make a television, like a miniseries or a TV show, I would, A, I would be really, really happy. And B, I would be interested to see if they would adjust for that at all. If they would, you know, play up the female characters, maybe just gender swap some of the men and make them women to give a little bit more balance. Because I definitely see what you're saying there, because when I think about it, I definitely, the characters that pop into my mind first are mostly the male characters. And I mean, you clearly remember these books a lot better than I do. So when I'm remembering a few characters, I'm literally just really remembering a few characters, and they're almost all dudes. So actually, that kind of moves us into the last thing I wanted to talk about here before we go. I am very curious about, do you have any expectations for this reread? Is there anything you're particularly looking forward to? Or is there something that you're kind of nervous about as we take this journey? Because for me, I am really excited to dig into it and like remember the things that I clearly don't remember. But I am also a little bit nervous that I'm going to run into more stuff like that. I'm going to read the women this time through and be like, oh yeah, I wish that they were stronger or better, or, you know, hit some places where
there sure are a lot of femme fatales.
Right? Like, okay, this is supposed to be the future where people are, you know, psychic and society is starting to get great. And, you know, are we going to run across some, you know, conventions or really racist stuff that just stands out now and makes me feel kind of squicky? I don't know. What about you?
So I was going to say, it's a mix of both dreading and kind of anticipating how to read them through the lens of this particular point in current events. Because, you know, one of the things I do remember from the books is there's a sense of ethno-nationalism as a personality construct. People take pride in being Scottish. They take pride in being French-Canadian. They take pride in being Chinese. And at a time when we have rising nationalism as an excuse for...
really bad stuff.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious to see how that colors my reaction to this authorial thing I know is coming up. So I'm curious. I'm eager. I'm also hoping I can read it by cataloging my reactions and going, okay, how much of this is just something that's persistent across all the rereads versus how much is me reacting to a very 21st century mindset? Because I think that's something that has to come up when you do a reread is it's like, I like being able to reread things in the context of the now and be like, oh, this was written then. Here's how I'm processing it now. But I think it's also incumbent to keep in mind, like, when something was written and what may have been going on at that time too. So, you know, it's kind of like you're rereading it in two different ways. Mm-hmm. And now listeners are like, this is too much work. I just signed on for one reread. But, you know, I am a little nervous to see how I perceive some characters. I'm mostly excited. I'm excited to see if I can see them with fresh eyes. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited to see what I've missed from the last few times. Because, you know, this is a writer who, again, puts down something in one book and picks it up at the end of a ninth book. And you're like, oh! So, you know, like, what else has she been putting in there that I didn't see because I was just, like, racing through the pages to find out how things happened? Mm-hmm. You know, like, because that does, I don't know if that's ever happened to you where you find yourself just like breathlessly gulping in each page because you're just so eager to find out what happens. And what I've noticed is when I do that, I do have to go back and do a more careful reread because then, you know, I do miss things that are either important or gratifying later on.
Yeah, I definitely tend to be a very like plot focused and character focused reader, which is that brings me to one of the other things that I'm excited about for this reread and talking about it with you, because I know that you pay much more attention to sort of like the themes of what is happening and how it relates to the larger society and, you know, perhaps the author and all that kind of stuff. And that is stuff that I tend to not dig into unless I am sort of prompted to. So I'm excited to be prompted.
No, I can't wait to talk about characters with you because I think you're going to have takes on a lot of these folks that will just really help my understanding of them and help me not be very knee-jerk about them.
It's good.
Brian Grenfell.
Oh, Brian.
You know, like, again, the first time I read about what happened to him, I was really upset. But he didn't have a chance to redeem himself. But he never got. And then, like, the second time I read through, I was like, oh. And so I'm kind of looking forward to reading it now to see what I think of him again, mm-hmm. you know?
Yep, for sure. So. All right. Well, this has been every bit as delightful as I expected. And I hope I can say the same for the books themselves as we move forward.
I'm so excited to do this with you, Erica. Yay!
So until next time, I have not yet come up with a clever sign-off. So maybe that's something you can look forward to in our next episode. Saga of Rereading Epics is a proud part of the Incomparable Podcast Network. Visit theincomparable.com for more geeky podcasts. And while you're there, you can become a member, support the show, and get future episodes of this podcast right now.